I have
current geek.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Current Geek. This is Current Geek, the autopilot edition of the show. In fact, a chance for us to watch the pilot episode of a TV show and geek out about it. I'm Scott Johnson. He's Tom Merritt. And this week, we're talking about HBO's The Sopranos.
Yes, I will be doing my... I can't pull that off.
It's not a simp show about singers? Is that what you're saying?
I was going to make a joke that I was going to do the entire commentary in a soprano tone.
Oh, you should have done it.
Which I wasn't going to do. But I couldn't even get the joke out.
I would pay big money to hear you.
Well, because I'm more of a baritone.
Yeah, you're a low voice. We call you in the
baritones
biz.
Is yeah. An entirely different. Well, because that's the other thing. It's named after Tony Soprano. It's just his last name. Is yeah. Soprano an actual surname though?
I don't know. It's funny you ask that because I've always wondered and never bothered to look it up. I assume you could
Soprano.
probably could trace some back. To somebody. Let's see. As a name, I'm looking here. Soprano. What does the name mean? I mean, they may have taken it and just said, hey, every other name in Italy has been used 1,000 times in mob movies. Why don't we make ours, make one up? You know, it's entirely possible.
The Sopranos are mostly from California.
Mm.
According to Ancestry.com.
The Sopranos fly back to Capistrano.
A topographic name for someone who lived at the top end of a place on a hillside.
Oh. So literally at the top end, there's just like The Voice.
Higher. Yeah. You're higher. Hence probably why people who sing high are also called Sopranos.
Oh, see, we've learned something today already, and we haven't even talked about the show. It's The Sopranos, a show that I watched. Let's see, this would be my... If I keep going, this will be my third time through. I came to it late though. I wasn't there at 99 or 2000, whatever it was, when it premiered.
Right. It premiered on January 10th, 1999, mm-hmm. With the pilot episode, which had been shot 2 years before. It took a while for them to go from pilot into shooting the first season. I'm curious because I haven't seen any more of the episodes if that shows up. But this first episode was written and directed by David Chase.
Right. And I watched, I slid into episode two because I was curious about that fact about the being filmed so much later. And it's not immediately obvious, but I actually think there is a tonal difference between the pilot and not. For example, and you're not going to know this because you haven't watched the whole series, but this whole thing with his psychiatrist that is so central to the first episode, they continue that on, but it pretty quickly starts to be less and less important, and eventually it's not important at all.
So it's no longer like the main framing device of every episode.
Correct.
Because that's kind of what, just reading about the show, it said that character, the analyst, stays throughout the run.
Yep.
And interacts. But what you're saying is this sort of like, we start every act of the episode by, you know, checking in with the analyst and seeing the progress or lack of progress that he may or may not be making. That element.
Yeah, it's not an episodic thing that they use as a framing device. They do go back to it, and I think they do. I think it's really smartly and well done. But you would get the impression, I think, from the first episode, the pilot, that maybe that is the thing. Mm-hmm, that this is just going to be Tony Soprano always sort of making recollections, giving her much watered down versions of the events in his life and stuff, and that might be the gimmick, if for lack of a better term. And it's not really how it plays out. It plays out a lot more, I don't know what to compare this to. I mean, a lot of ways they broke a lot of new ground in the way they tell these stories. And so I feel like referencing something else, but maybe I'm just referencing The Sopranos because a lot of other people do that now. But it's a little Goodfellas, I guess. And I don't just mean because of the mob stuff. I mean, the way things are cut.
27 characters that
are
shared between the movie Goodfellas and the entire run of Sopranos.
That's true. But there's also just kind of a rhythm that's familiar. Tony deals with these panic attacks and this stuff that's, you know, totally for him, you know, not him. That feels like somebody else's problem. It would never be a Tony Soprano problem. Yet here he is having this problem. And he deals with that for a number of other episodes. It comes back in other weird ways. The show definitely, and this is one of the things that's so great about it, it definitely deals with family issues at home with the Sopranos, and then immediately with, you know, the quote unquote business, which often involves murders and cover-ups and, you know, throwing bodies in the East River and all the stuff you get out of your mob stereotypes and tropes. And they do it so well that it is just a delight the entire way through. And I loved it. And I'm pretty sure I'm going to enter into my third viewing now, because this happens on this show and I can't help it. Me and Tom,
I could, you know, absolutely see why. Yeah. I'm dying to continue watching. I don't have time to continue watching, but I might just make time to continue watching. Mm-hmm. And part of me is thinking, well, maybe I can convince Brian Brushwood to make this one of our Spoiler in Time library watches, because I don't know that he has seen it either.
Oh.
But yeah, I'm chomping at the bit to find a reason to watch this. Because like you say, it's just really well crafted and well done. It was originally conceived of as a movie. Mm. Chase wanted to make a movie about a mobster in therapy. So that, hence the framing being so heavy in that first episode, that was kind of the original thought. And then his manager convinced him to turn it into a TV script. He pitched it to Fox. Fox was interested, but eventually passed. And then he took it to HBO, and HBO financed a pilot that, like I said, was shot in 1997. HBO executives put the show on hold for a few months. Chase considered maybe just pitching it as a movie again, saying, let's just shoot 45 more minutes and turn this into a movie. But then they greenlit it.
I'm glad they did it, because it did two things. It started HBO's long run in creative television, I think. In some ways, you could say, well, what about the Larry Sanders Show? Or what about...
Oh, sure. Fraggle Rock.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, they had done very creative television shows before that. But this kicked off the modern era of HBO.
Oh, television. Absolutely. I think I think what we see today with things like Ascension. What's it called? Is it Ascension? The one with the Watchmen? No. What would you call it? What'd you say?
Watchmen.
No, not. But that's a good example too. But like that show that everybody's into, where it's about a super rich family and the sons are trying to take the business over.
Oh, Succession.
Succession, not Ascension. Jeez.
Yeah.
Anyway, I haven't watched that yet. But from all accounts, it sounds like one of these really high quality, edgy HBO dramas. I think you could even say Game of Thrones owes a debt of gratitude, sure, to what happened with The Sopranos. So yeah, in a lot of ways it was. But man, there are people out there that will fight you that say FX's The Shield, sure, deserves this honor, that it was the beginning of this kind of television. And I've seen that as well twice over, and I'll agree that it's amazing, but I don't know who wins. We can have both, is what I'm saying.
Well, The Sopranos, I don't think there's any argument that The Sopranos kicked off this era for HBO.
Oh, yeah.
Whether it also kicked off the era writ large or not, we can leave as an exercise for the audience.
Yeah.
But it's certainly, like, in the world of HBO, there is an argument over which is the better television show, The Wire or Sopranos. Mm-hmm. And when I say within the world of HBO, that's also an argument over which is the best television show of all time, often.
Right.
They both are considered to be candidates, as are other shows. I'm not saying that they're the only two, but often for some critics, it does come down to Sopranos versus The Wire.
Yeah, I will say this in support of this, not necessarily over The Wire, but early on, let's say pilot-wise, this is a much more cohesive, get right into it, moments of humor, moments of real shock. Like, let's go fire this off. Brand new series. Awesome. Sopranos pilot. I think The Wire starts really slowly and
definitely
takes
does.
You some definitely time.
Does. If so, you're not a patient person,
yeah,
The Wire is going to be difficult for you, especially that first season.
Yeah. But you get around, you know, you'll get around to it and it'll be, oh, okay, well, this is perhaps the greatest show ever.
Whereas you're right, The Sopranos, they're kicking the crap out of that guy who owes gambling money, within the first half hour or so. Mm-hmm. There's some action. There's some stuff going down. There's intrigue. There's secrets. There's restaurants blowing up. Like, it's action packed.
Yep.
And I was surprised when I found out after watching it that this was in fact a real pilot, because, you know, we play fast and loose with autopilot. Autopilot is a way for us to talk about a television show. We focus on watching only the pilot. and talking about that, but we range off into other areas and we kind of think of it as our way of being able to talk about shows. So when there is a show like Game of Thrones, where they just made the entire first season, the first show isn't really a pilot, I'm used to that. And that's what I was expecting after watching Sopranos, because it felt so well put together. I'm like, oh, well, this is obviously just part of the season. But no, this was an actual honest to goodness pilot. It was shot separately on its own. It was evaluated before the rest of the series was greenlit. And it does not look like one to me.
Mm-mm. No, it feels like, oh, like I feel like this is a standard now. Like a lot of newer shows don't feel like pilots anymore. I feel like gone are the days of where everything looks a little rusty and a little half done.
Yeah,
where
you get a different face in the pilot episode.
Yeah, and this, by all accounts, this should probably have that feeling because, like you said, it was filmed in 97. They didn't go to publish or whatever.
Yeah, 2 years I'm trying to find the exact dates. They did start shooting the rest of the show in late 97, but it was months between. This was not part of a continuous production.
Yeah. The other thing I would say is it feels like a show that, even though it ended in 2007, so we're well over 10 years ago, a couple of years over that, it had, you know, I guess roughly a 7-year run, almost 8-year run. The seasons are short. They're not super long. It's like 12 episodes per season. It's not a huge show in terms of overall length. But
yeah, they shot it in 97 and they got the order for the rest of the episodes in December of 97. Oh, okay. So they didn't start shooting those until 98.
Gotcha. But here's the thing, watching it, even just the pilot, you know, I'm noticing how young everybody is because, you know, they age as we get older, as we get to the final season in 2007. But even though that's all true, everything in this thing feels really timeless. None of this feels like late 90s to me at all. Or early 2000s for that matter. It really holds up and it just continues to hold up the more you get into it.
Oh, yeah. It's funny. There were some parts that felt like it was a period piece that were contemporary.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, things that they were doing, like when the daughter was online and you saw the AOL, you heard the "you got mail."
Yep.
"You've got mail" thing. And what was great is they didn't play it up. Mm-mm. That was just a thing that was naturally happening at that time. And that's how it read to me in 2019. Like, oh, okay, this is set in the 90s. Got it.
Right. Yeah, there's definitely that. There's also just a timelessness to that part of Jersey. Everything.
And
just,
these attitudes. And
yeah,
everything.
And the way they're...
That is one of the criticisms people have is they feel like this continues a unrepresentative stereotype of Italian Americans.
Yeah, and I think that there's something. I actually think they're probably right to some degree, but it's part of what I love about this stuff. I don't mean stereotypes. I don't mean, you know, taking people and being general about them. What I mean is they lean into the genre, and the genre has that.
Right.
And I don't know how you escape it if you're going to lean into an Italian mob family in New Jersey. I just don't know how you escape it. Maybe there's a way.
Well, I think what's really interesting to consider here is that Chase's defense is we are not trying to show Italian Americans. We are showing a subculture of Italian Americans. And I think the answer back to that is, well, we have seen plenty of that. We don't need to see more of that. That's what everybody thinks all Italian Americans. If you wanted to do something good for Italian Americans, you'd show a side that wasn't a mafia crime family. And I think that's a fair criticism. But if you look at it as, okay, but there are people who are criminals and some of them are Italian Americans, and this is a look at that world. David Chase is writing about the world he grew up in. He grew up in New Jersey, and these are based on real people from New Jersey and their lives. And I can tell from the first episode, and a lot of what I've read has backed me up on this, these are not Godfather. These are not Goodfellas. These are certainly not James Cagney stories. These are stories of a suburban family. And I got that from that first episode of, this isn't about the mafia. This is about a father and his children and how he deals with that and his job, which happens to be running a crime mob.
Right.
Or at least being a capo in one.
Right. And then it's so good throughout the series too, because her knowledge of what he actually does, Edie Falco's knowledge, is so much fun to watch from the perspective of, you know that she kind of knows it's something dirty.
Everybody knows who Tony Soprano is. Come on.
Yeah, it's kind of dirty, but on the other hand, she's just sort of pretending like it's not, and she does her best to do that. She does her best to raise her kids away from this part of stuff, which, you know, that gets interesting down the line. It's a fascinating portrayal by her. She, you know, rightly so, won multiple Emmys for this role and kind of became, you know, as renowned as she is now for this role. Went on to do cool stuff like Nurse Jackie and other things, but this is really her big iconic first thing. And I find her to be one of the most captivating characters in TV history. Part of me just wants to say, Tom, I don't care if you want to watch it or not. You have to. Like, I feel like you have to watch it. It's just so good.
I hear you.
It's so good.
Because Edie Falco, Carmella, mm-hmm. her character is not, to me, the typical mob boss wife.
Right.
Right? She is, in fact, a suburban housewife. Mm-hmm. She, you know, doesn't just kind of, you know, let Tony do whatever Tony wants to do. The whole thing with the ducks is such a middle-aged dad thing, right? Like, and it gets weird when it starts, when you start to realize what it represented for him and it's a loss and everything. But at the beginning, it's like, oh yeah, no, I can remember my dad just being fascinated with weird stuff like that sometimes. And the rest of us just being like, yeah, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Okay,
it's
fine,
weirdly relatable in that way. Right.
Like, yeah, totally.
I was like, wait a minute. I feel like even now, like I'm the guy with the obsession with the ducks in the pool and that doesn't entirely go away. That duck thing is a thing we get to return to thematically throughout the series. Because basically what we're seeing is like, there's three midlife crises happening. There's Tony's actual midlife crisis. There's the mob as a modern institution of crime's midlife crisis.
Okay.
Where it's trying to struggle with itself and it doesn't really have the identity it used to. And they keep, this pilot really pounds into you that these guys, a lot of the wise guys end up turning state's evidence, going to witness protection, or they write books about what happened, or they... You know, they just duck out of when they're in prison, they snitch on everybody. And one of Tony's big complaints is it's not like it used to be where everybody backed everybody up and we had rules and everything. And the second episode really starts to lean into that.
You only serve 2 days.
Exactly.
They go in, they go out.
Exactly.
That's the wire, but still.
Still, same concept. And the third midlife is New Jersey itself, because the show deals with things like gentrification and the changing attitude and the modernization and the internet and all of these things have an impact on what is traditionally a mob story. And it's a fun thing. I don't know if they ever get explicit about that. David Chase, when he talks about his inspiration or anything, I couldn't find much about this, but that's the sense I have, is that this is a thing where they're just leaning into this idea that a place, a time, and a guy are all having a midlife crisis, and here's how we're going to deal with it. And that's, on the surface, that may sound even kind of silly and simple, but it's not, and it plays out in really interesting ways. These side characters, like, you barely get to meet Polly in this, but Polly is one of my favorite second.
Polly Walnuts?
Yes. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I love him so much. And he's just ridiculous.
Well, that's Tony Sirico too. Like, immediately, like, oh yeah, here's another Goodfellas character.
Yeah, he's great. And so is the saxophone dude from
Steve Van Zandt.
Yes, he's
great. Who I have seen Lilyhammer, which is a spinoff,
right?
Very loosely, like of Sopranos,
right?
And I love him in that. Apparently, Steven Van Zandt, if anyone doesn't know, Steven Van Zandt is a saxophone player for the E Street Band, Bruce Springsteen's band.
Yeah,
he was cast because David Chase saw him at the Rock and Roll Music Hall of Fame and liked him the way he talked, the way he carried himself, and thought he would make a great soprano. In fact, he auditioned for Tony Soprano. HBO sort of weighed in and said, man, I think we want a more experienced actor, or an experienced actor,
right?
Because Steven Van Zandt had never acted before.
Right. He's very good in this. And throughout the series, all the way up to the very end, he's one of my favorite people to watch in this thing. Another great one is Junior, played by Dominic Chianci. Anyway, he's in a bunch of other mob stuff. He's fantastic. Uncle Junior is both funny and miserable and awful.
Oh,
and
the
great.
Uncle. Yeah.
He is so good. Michael Imperioli is Christopher.
Dominic Chianci.
Yeah. There you go. Great, great name. Michael Imperioli is amazing as Christopher. He's just this up-and-comer.
I remember he was all over the place, like doing tequila ads and stuff when Sopranos was at its height.
Yeah.
It's not like he's gone away or anything, but like, this really launched a lot of careers. I mean, Edie Falco had a career before this.
Sure.
But a lot of these folks, like Stephen Van Zandt, even James Gandolfini, didn't. They were unknowns at the time, and now they're famous because of Sopranos.
Oh, yeah. And Gandolfini, who went on to do all kinds of other stuff and sadly died in 2013 at the young age of 51 while he was in Italy for a film festival, which is a huge bummer because I think that guy is like a just a treasure of an actor. Treasure. He really
he's
is
that
great.
Kind of guy, yeah.
Like even in things like he's the voice of Carol, one of the monsters in Where the Wild Things Are.
Mm-hmm.
He's so nuanced in that role and it comes across so great. I don't think it's as good without him. Like I just miss the dude. And there's lots of great little movies he did between Sopranos and his passing. I recommend almost all of them. They're all really good.
It's a little bit of a side jag here, but it shows that because you're not in a famous production,
mm-hmm.
is not an evaluation of character.
Right.
We oftentimes hear, well, what has he done? What
mm-hmm.
has she done?
Mm-hmm.
Before Sopranos, he had done a lot. Dance with the Devil. He was in the TV movie 12 Angry Men. He had been working since 1987.
Mm-hmm.
So 12 years with regular credits, working hard.
Sure.
Nobody knew he was.
Right.
Put him in Sopranos and suddenly people appreciated him.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all it takes sometimes is the perfect role match. And he didn't even think it was the perfect role. There's this great quote here where he says, this is on the show back in 99. He read the project. He says, I liked it. I thought it was good, but I thought they would have to hire some good looking guy, not George Clooney, but some Italian George Clooney. And that would be that. But they called me and said I needed to meet with David Chase for breakfast. He says, at the time I was younger and I was staying out late a lot. And I was like, oh, are you kidding me? There's no way this is going to work.
Breakfast.
Yeah, he just basically couldn't believe it. But it is the best casting. Like, I just didn't want it. And when it ends in 07, I was so bummed. I just wanted to keep
going.
Having
not even seen The Sopranos, I can't imagine anyone else
right?
as Tony Soprano.
I know.
Before I watched this pilot, James Gandolfini is like, oh, Sopranos.
Yeah.
I haven't even watched the show.
Yeah, he inhabits it in such a way that I don't even know how to describe this, but he's got his foot on one saying, well, he's got one foot on the side that's like, hey, here are some typical tough guy Italian stereotype mob boss moments. And here's this other foot in this other uncharted zone of what about my feelings? And you know, I got all this other stuff, which really plays out interestingly through the whole thing. Like if there was any mistake to the pilot, it was that they really showed their hand on how much this was going to be about Tony dealing with his mother, Tony dealing with his dad. There's a couple of throwback episodes later in the first season, I think, where you get to see his young mother and father and him as a boy and kind of learn what that whole family dynamic was like. And they really do a great job of fleshing that stuff out. If anything, the pilot tried to cram a lot of that in. And maybe, you know, what you were saying earlier about this was almost a movie with it and it just needed an extra 45 minutes or whatever. Maybe that's a sign of that. I don't know. But
mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Maybe David Chase had a little bit of that pressure or the idea kind of weighing on him.
But it's a very small, I mean, it's barely.
And we are going to get a movie prequel in March of last year, 2018. New Line Cinema announced a Sopranos background story set in the 1960s during the Newark riots. The title, as far as we know, is The Many Saints of Newark, written by David Chase, along with Lawrence Connor, directed by Alan Taylor, and
starring his son, right? Isn't his
starring
son?
His son as a young version of Tony Soprano.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
What a cool thing that is. I mean, A, it's going to feel good because we'll see his face in him, you know, and it'll be like,
yeah, it'll be like, oh yeah, that totally looks like a young James Gandolfini because, well, it's his son.
Yeah, but the bonus is the kid must just be, I mean, that must be just, I say kid, he's probably in his 20s or something, but he must be just thrilled with this. In fact,
it's Michael Gandolfini.
Michael Gandolfini, how old is he? Because I'm guessing he was born around the time they shot the pilot. If you think about it, like, let's say, Michael.
He is, I don't have an actual age on him yet.
I can't find it. Oh, there it is. Who's in the deuce? He was born in 19, doesn't say.
19 doesn't say. One of my favorite years. It's a great year for Zinfandel.
I know, right? You got to watch for those dates. he's in, that's going to annoy me. But he, I want to say he's like 22. He's born in 97, like the year they filmed this thing.
He is 19.
Oh, he's younger than I thought even. Okay.
Yeah.
So he's Nick's age, 2000. All right. Well, good for him. And I hope that's rad. And if David Chase is right.
Town crier.
Yeah. Isn't this kind of weird, though, to think that we're on the other side of this groundbreaking HBO stuff, which felt so new. And now we're on the other side of it where we're getting Deadwood movies and this thing's coming up.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really weird. That's another pilot we got to do. We got to do Deadwood.
Deadwood. Oh, yeah. And I have watched that. And I will happily risk having to watch that entire series again watching the pilot.
That'll be my fourth watch through if I get forced through that thing again, because I loved it.
Well, and that's kind of the holy trinity of early. Oh, I can't believe I'm going to call it early HBO. Mm-hmm. But because early HBO is actually the 80s, but
right.
the early modern, the Pleistocene HBO. Mm-hmm. But Sopranos really did mark a change for HBO. That's when people started to think of HBO as a place. Well, maybe I should subscribe and watch the shows. Mm-hmm. I don't care so much about movies, but maybe the shows, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it was Sopranos, and it was The Wire, and it was Deadwood.
Yeah.
And Sopranos was the first of the HBO movies to get, in fact, it was the first cable movie to get an Emmy for best drama.
Mm-hmm.
Oz predated Sopranos and sort of was the first hour-long drama that HBO did. And it got critical acclaim too, but not as much as Sopranos did.
No, that was also really, Oz was weird. And by that, I mean, it was ethereal and
a little more experimental.
And,
yeah.
Yeah. It felt like somebody's student film just gone amok, and it was kind of hard for me to keep up with, but I guess props where it's deserved. It was an early one of these, but you know, then you look down the road and go, you know, wow, like almost Netflix followed the same pattern. Well, if you don't count the rental period of Netflix, but if you count the streaming period, it's all movies and old TV shows, and then their own content starts, and their first original was, I guess it was the Kevin Spacey thing, House of Cards, right? Wasn't that their first original? Something like that.
Well, Lilyhammer was the first real original, because it was something that hadn't shown it elsewhere in the United States.
Oh.
But it was done in cooperation with the Finnish broadcaster.
Gotcha.
Or Norwegian broadcaster.
But you look at it now, and they're like,
but House of Cards was the first one that Netflix made just for itself.
Right. And now that network, or that, you know, service is just a big not an HBO ripoff, but it followed that pattern and is now sort of deep into that template.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's where everybody's headed. You know, Prime is kind of there now too. We're working toward it. And I think even Hulu, you know, when once you start getting like Emmy noms and wins for your original series on your streaming services, which they're all getting these days, all the major ones are. We're basically in HBO multiple land, and now we got HBO about to launch a whole new thing with, you know, Warner Brothers, who owns HBO, is about to launch HBO Max, which puts them solidly in the spotlight of, oh, another thing from these guys. But in a lot of ways, everybody kind of owes them a little bit of a thanks for breaking ground, you know? I don't know.
Well, Brian talks about on Cord Killer sometimes the fact that it took cable 20 years, took him to The Sopranos to get an Emmy for an actual a drama that they put on, such that they created the ACE Awards. Remember the ACE Awards?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, because they wanted to have awards for cable. And streaming services have just kind of jumped in there after a few years.
Yeah, it's very cool. Back to the actual deal. One thing you didn't know, well, I don't know how pilots work for, in this case, like in HBO's case, when they ordered this up, did they know that they were going to go ahead with, you know, 7 seasons of this thing? Like, I don't know how that works. Cause in regular TV, it's like, well, we'll
back
order
then
a pilot.
It was pretty unknown. You would just say like, I've got an idea of where this is going, and you would want to do as many seasons as possible. It wasn't really till Lost that the idea of saying, you know what, I have an end, and I don't want to do as many seasons as possible, I want to have an end, started to be something that was paid attention to.
Right. Well, to me, that's interesting, just given the way it works now. Usually, as far as I know, if a series looks interesting to HBO or to Netflix or to somebody else, they'll just order it. You know, they're like, well, let's go.
Although HBO was trying to push Game of Thrones. Game of Thrones had a very definitive 6-season arc.
Yeah, that's true.
Or maybe it was 7. A 7-season arc. And HBO wanted it to keep going. mm-hmm. to the point that they split the seventh season into 7 and 8 against sort of the inclination of Benioff and Weiss. Sometimes I wonder if some of the backlash has to do with that. But HBO was even like, oh, can we just keep it going? Can we keep the magic going forever? You know, like,
yeah.
It's still hard for network executives to want to do that.
Yeah, that whole thing deserves, well, you guys do a lot on Cord Killers and stuff, but that whole thing deserves some analysis after some time has passed.
Yeah, I think
feel,
so.
Need I feel like distance. those split seasons probably just put them together and make one, and it's a better season, and then we don't think of it in the way we're all thinking of it now, but maybe... If they, with all the holes and problems it does have, how much of that was HBO's pressure to just keep going? And these guys are like, man, you know, you have no idea what this is doing to everyone.
But the point being, when Sopranos launched, I don't think there was any expectation of having an end in mind.
Yeah, probably not. I don't know. It's fun to think of that stuff, but it really gets going. And if I had any recommendation for Tom Merritt this day, today, right now, this minute, it is continue somehow. Find a way to continue The Sopranos if you can.
I want to point out that I did catch one change in the pilot that kind of might throw some people off, you know, so I want to warn myself if I continue, as Scott is encouraging me to. The Satriali's pork store is called the Centani's Meat Market in the pilot.
Oh, so later that, okay, I wasn't aware of that. Yeah.
Beware, because the next episode, it's not going to be Centani's anymore. Don't get used to that.
Yeah, their names were originally Baritone. They changed it last second. Now it's all Soprano.
No, I don't. I can't find a citation on that one.
Yeah, it's hard to prove. It's pure hearsay as far as I'm concerned.
There's another bit of this that I think helps bring it home, and this is something that I think they used on The Wire as well. This was shot in New Jersey.
Yeah.
The interior shots are some done at a studio in New York, but you know, the exterior of the house is in North Caldwell, New Jersey. The pork store is a building they bought and turned into the pork store and used in New Jersey. They actually tore the building down after they were done using it for shooting. But you know, all those exterior shots, they wanted to get across to you that this isn't New York. This isn't New York City. And I think that works.
Yeah. And there's a thing in the intro, which they change later. And it's always the same intro. He's in his car, smoking a cigar. That iconic music's playing, and he's just driving through town. And as you're driving through town, you're seeing old, dirty, nasty Jersey, and it slowly evolves into, hey, it looks nicer. And then eventually you're at his like way too rich house where he gets out and up comes the name. In that sequence, they show a shot from over the bridge where you can see the two towers. And that's in this intro in the pilot. And that stays until 2001. When that happened, it was one of the first examples of a television show that I'm aware of where they removed it. So from then on, every intro, I guess from 01 till 07, every intro no longer had a shot of the trade towers up there, which is interesting.
Yeah, it was a different... that was the only difference, though. Everything else stayed the same.
Yeah, all the same, yep. In fact, I think there's still... It's not like they just cut it. Because it's the same length, they just interstitialed something else there, like another shot of a building or something, and it's just not the two towers anymore. But it was interesting, because I just remember at the time thinking, there are a lot of movies and TV shows that have the World Trade Center in it. How are they going to treat that? And some pulled it and took it out. Others left it in and said, why would we take it out? That's, you know, we're letting the terrorists win if we take it out or whatever. Mm-hmm. So you'll see episodes of Friends... And it's there it is, and, you know, some shot or another. You'll see a movie like Spider-Man, the first Sam Raimi Spider-Man, and they took all that stuff out. So it just sort of depended, but this is one of those cases where they took it out of the intro. It was just too raw, too soon, too whatever.
Yeah.
But I always liked it at the time. The effect was, oh, yeah, we're in Jersey. We're seeing glitzy New York from way over here.
Yeah, yeah.
And that adds to this this weird Jersey mystique. That is The Sopranos, and it's very effective.
And you mentioned the opening theme, Woke Up This Morning. That is an example of the fact that they just use pre-recorded music.
Yeah.
Not a lot of score.
Nope.
In this, if you noticed. Woke Up This Morning is remixed and performed by a British band called Alabama 3. Mm-hmm. But throughout the series, apparently, they just used, you know, songs from Van Morrison and The Kinks and Andrea Bocelli and stuff like that.
Yeah, and a lot of it is background and not used for drama.
Yeah, it's not most, diegetic, yeah, as they say.
It reminds me, I mean, I love No Country for Old Men for a billion reasons, but one of them is they use no music in there. There's like a weird discordant sound at the beginning and at the end, mm-hmm. and then the rest of it is just musicless, and it adds so much to that movie when you'd think it would take away. And the show is a lot like that. Most of the violence is done in without, you know, music to try to make you feel one way or the other.
Which is not that music isn't good when done well. I mean, I'm a huge fan of John Williams and,
of course,
Michael Giacchino.
If there's one thing I love in this world the most, it's really good movie and, for that matter, video game scoring is amazing. But my like of it here, I think, has to do with the material. Like, the material doesn't need it. And in some ways, the show was very good at showing very, very violent ideas or scenes without trying to make you feel a way about it. You were left just to feel what you would naturally feel, is a little bit of repulsion, a little bit of like, oh, well, that's stark and awful. And there's no music to punctuate it. You're just sort of standing there with a smoking gun and a bleeding guy on a table. Like that when Michael,
when they kick the guy at the, what is it, the insurance company?
Yeah, HMO thing. Yeah.
I wasn't sure if I bought that everyone would just kind of stand around looking disgusted and not weigh in. But I thought that that was supposed to imply to me that everybody knew that was Tony Soprano's people.
Right.
And that they all felt bad for the guy getting kicked, but didn't want to get in their way and didn't want to get involved.
Exactly. That would also be my take. Although I feel like somebody would have, in a real life scenario, even if they knew that was Tony, somebody would have said something or
maybe
something.
Although I also feel like it's more realistic that no one did, that they just kind of look like, oh man, that sucks. If they all know who Tony Soprano is, if they all know about, you know, this mafia,
right?
They didn't take it too far. They didn't kill the guy in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
They just beat him up. And I could see people saying, well, gosh, I'm not going to really save the guy. I'm just going to get myself in hot water.
Right.
Like, that feels more real to me. And you don't have somebody standing up and saying, hey, now, what are you doing? Like, I work for Tony Soprano. Oh, sorry. Oh,
sorry.
Like, you don't need that. Yeah.
No, you're right. You probably don't. Throughout the complete series, it's a fun juxtaposition, because on the one hand, he is scary and he is feared and he is known and all those things. He's legendary and people, you know, get out of his way. He's notorious. But on the other hand, he's at this time in his life where he's taking simple pleasure and the ducks are here. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, and they play on that so well, and just dealing with issues with his kids and trying to bond with his son and trying to keep a connection with his daughter, and the way she's always fighting with Meadow, he's got a better relationship with her, and that causes issues with the marriage. Like, these are things just people deal with, and that's what made the show so different. This could just be crime after crime after crime, but instead it was a whole bunch of crimes and then home life and then family life, and his mother's just driving him crazy.
Oh, his mother.
She is something else, dude.
His mother is the internet.
Does she, like,
you know, nothing you do is good enough. Everything is awful. All the people that she likes in her memory are saints, right? Like, it's amazing.
That's really a great way to look at that. I hadn't ever thought of it that way, but yes, she is the internet, and she gets worse as the series goes on. And the way he has to deal with her just gets more intense. Uncle Junior is the most passive aggressive force of life in a TV show. And the older he gets, the less he feels, the more impotent he feels about life and his position as anyone in that family. And so he starts to do really drastic things to change that. It's an amazing arc. Oh, I'm going to watch it again.
Here's something where you know the answer, so I don't want you to tell me. But what I loved was that bit in the car when the uncle is driving the mom.
Yeah.
And he's just kind of throwing out a test line of like, I think Tony's overstepping his bounds. I think he's getting out of line. I think, you know, and she pushes back a little bit, and he just like, I don't know, but, you know, maybe he needs to be taught a lesson kind of attitude.
Yeah.
And you can't, what I love is you can't tell at this point whether the uncle has crossed a line, because we know the mom is, you know, antagonistic with her son, but there's also love. You know, it's very muted, but it's there.
Yep.
So you don't know if the uncle crossed a line and the mom is going to I know she's not going to eliminate him, but, you know, is going to slap him down. Or if she's like, yeah, my no good son, you know, you're right. And go in league with him. And I love that there's, you could see it go either way at that point.
Right.
It's really elegantly conveyed.
Yeah. And you'll see it throughout the series that back and forth is super interesting between those two. It's also, you know, this is her deceased husband's brother, the character. And then, and I remember thinking at the time, is this what happens? Like, in-laws get older and they get catty and weird. And like, I've started to see this in some extended family a little bit. And I don't know, it really resonates. There's something about Uncle Junior and Tony's mom that reminds me of uncles and aunts I have. And I can't get it out of my head. At the time I watched it, I felt like that. I was like, oh, this is too real. This is like driving me crazy. But she is amazing. She is extremely good at being this thing she is. And they hint at it in the episode. She is absolutely not being upfront about what a saint her husband was.
Well, no, I mean, you do get the sort of like she hated him, you know, every day when he was alive, and now he's a saint. So, yeah.
And don't forget, dude, down the road, Steve Buscemi joins this cast for 14 episodes. It's incredible, his run. You got a bunch of other people that you'll just love. Joey Pantoliano, or however you say his name.
Joey Pants.
He's amazing for his run on this. Like, there are so many rip-roaring, amazing sequences and characters. Some are only temporary, but they're just, they leave a mark. Ah, it's so good. It's so good.
What is the one where they're like, where they have two people named the same, one of whom is the one they want to kill?
Big Pussy and Little Pussy.
Yes. Yes. I love that moment. I feel like they did this on purpose. I love that. I'm like, wait a minute. Is this the guy they want to kill?
Right.
He seems to be kind of, you know, like in charge-ish and he's influencing. Yeah. And then they make it clear, like immediately they're like, there's Big Pussy and Little Pussy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like,
they're great.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And then in some subsequent episodes, you learn who Little is. Big, played by Vincent Pastore, is amazing in this. I'm trying to think of what else you'd know him from. Lots of movies like Revolver and Al Pacino's Carlito's Way. Lots of mob stuff. But that dude's... nobody's wasted. Every cast member has a thing to do. They got a place in this thing. They just get better and better. I can't wait for this movie. When's this happening? When did we get that movie?
I don't think we have a date on it yet.
All right. I want to... The Many Saints of Newark, is that the one? No.
Yeah.
Oh, that's it.
That sounds right. Is that it?
Wait, no, that's... Oh, no, is this it?
Yeah, it's The Many Saints of Newark, right.
Okay. This is 2000.
Scheduled to be released on September 25th, 2020 by Warner Brothers.
Oh, there it is. Okay. There's a bunch of people in this I didn't know were in this. Like John Barenthal, Vera Farmiga. These guys are great. Ray anyway, Liotta. I can't wait for this. So 2020, you're looking at September of next year. So about a year, a little less than a year. And we'll get to taste
this. I bet it goes to HBO Max.
Yeah, probably. I'm down with that. Like you said, go rent it for a month. Get it for a month, cancel it if you're done. Whatever. Exactly. I'm in. Well, this is great. If you guys haven't seen it yet, it seems like an obvious thing, but this is not for your children.
If you haven't seen one of the greatest television shows of all time, like me, yeah. Do.
And don't watch.
I can say, now that I've seen at least one episode, it's highly, highly worth it.
Yes. And it's all widescreen, which is also nice given its age. I was worried that.
Yeah, that's one thing with The Shield that kind of throws you. It's 4:3 mm-hmm. for the first several seasons.
Yeah, it's annoying. And
let's talk about the comparisons.
In this particular case.
Oh, and we almost forgot Matthew Weiner.
Oh,
Matthew
right.
Weiner yeah. writes 12 episodes. He's on the team for Sopranos, which of course eventually leads to Mad Men.
Yep. The Mad Men is one of these shows.
In that lineage.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Is it Weiner or Weiner? Weiner? Weiner.
Don't know.
I don't know.
Now that you've asked me, I don't want to say. You're probably wrong.
What was I going to say? I forgot. I don't know what I was going to say. Oh, I know. Just don't watch it with your kids. Not for kids at all.
Like, definitely not for kids.
No.
Right.
No.
Like Apple TV Plus shows. Yeah, not for kids.
Not for the children's. So keep take them over there to Netflix. Children for kids.
It, not children watching.
Yeah. Wait for Disney next week. Next week's Disney.
Wait for the Disney Plus version of The Sopranos.
Right. Hey, do you know? Sorry, quick tech question.
I think Sesame Street did some Sopranos stuff.
Actually. Do you know as DTNS Lord and Host if the app is going to be everywhere? Like, can people just get on whatever? Or are they starting with like, oh, well, this will start out as a, you know, Roku's and.
Oh, you mean like streaming boxes? Yes. It is available on most platforms with some exceptions.
One presumes iPads, iOS.
I don't have them all off the top of my head. I'm pretty sure Roku is on the list. I know Apple TV is.
Yeah. It's got to be iOS.
Device support. Here we go. Disney Plus will be available for streaming via web browsers, iOS, Apple TV, Android TV, Fire TV, Chromecast, Samsung Smart TV, LG, Roku, PlayStation, Xbox One, and Windows 10.
All right, then.
So pretty much everywhere. Yeah,
yeah, that's great. I mean, I don't know why I wouldn't have suspected otherwise, but I was curious.
Well, sometimes they're like, well, we haven't got a one ready yet, but not Disney. Disney's like, nope, we have them all.
We're big enough. We can do it. All right. So go watch The Sopranos and then prepare for next month when Autopilot will feature a very different show, but one that has a lot of influence. That's what they have in common, I guess. The Dick Van Dyke Show.
Yeah, kind of a show that is the root of many other things like Mary Tyler Moore Show, Lou Grant, you know, that all kind of birthed in a way out of the influence anyway of Dick Van Dyke.
It's also a show that my 19-year-old and my 22-year-old love and have kind of grown up with. They watch it on streaming still now. And I don't exactly know why, but they find an incredible amount of entertainment in it. And so I want to make the case that Gen Z and millennial-ish people have a broader appreciation of older content like this because of the era we live in with streaming and excess and all that.
I feel like Dick Van Dyke will, when we talk about it, will show itself to be a little bit of the I Love Lucy of the 1960s.
There you go. I like it. I actually think that's accurate. So we'll talk about that next month. We'll do the pilot for that. It will not be him tripping over the ottoman. That came later. That's the only thing I know for sure about the pilot is he does not trip on the ottoman yet. Anyway.
Yeah, he was still more agile.
Yeah. In fact, I think it may have even been different. He may not even walked out into the living room like he did in that yet or come home from work. Mm-hmm. It's something else. But anyway, it's always fun to look at that sort of stuff. We will talk about the Dick Van Dyke Show next month right here on Autopilot. And after we're done talking here, Legal Geek swoops in this week and describes a case involving Hasbro's Monopoly brand, which is changing filing practices for trademarks for all brand owners in the European Union. So board gamers, tabletop folks, stick around. You're getting a little piece for you today. Before we go, Tom Merritt, anything you want to tell the people at home?
Yeah, if you just like people talking about, we mentioned Daily Tech News Show, like tech news, but also pop culture, food, just sort of what's going on the internet. You might want to check out Good Day Internet. It is an expanded show with myself, Sarah Lane, and Roger Chang, and our guests, including Scott, on Wednesdays. Mm-hmm. And you can get it by becoming a patron, patreon.com/DTNS.
Speaking of which, we have a Patreon here as well. If you go over to patreon.com/currentgeek, you can support Current Geek and all the fun stuff we got going here. There's much more over at currentgeek.com as well as frogpants.com. So check that out. That's going to do it for us, for me, for Tom, for Tony, for everyone else. We'll see you next time.
The ducks.
'Welcome back to Legal Geek. This week we review how Hasbro and its Monopoly brand have surprisingly ended up being the center of a seminal case changing how trademark filing practice works in the European Union. Like many other jurisdictions, the European Union allows trademark registrations on brands and logos that have not yet gone into actual use, but eventually use in commerce must be proven to confirm the validity of the trademark. Whereas in the US, applicants are given up to 3 years to prove use to finalize a registration, in the EU, a 5-year grace period is provided before proof of use is necessary. The EU is more liberal as well, in that during that grace period, the trademark rights are still enforceable, unlike the US, where use is required before final registration or enforcement. As a result of this set of laws, many trademark owners in the EU have commonly refiled new applications, covering their brands before expiration of the 5 years, thereby resetting the clock on the grace period and avoiding the need to prove use through evidence. However, this practice is now in jeopardy after a case involving Hasbro and its famous Monopoly brand. Hasbro followed the common practice of refiling trademark applications for the Monopoly brand in several classes of goods and services before the end of a 5-year grace period in a pending prior registration. Hasbro's most recent refiling came under a cancellation attack from a company called Crevitani Dojati, specifically for violating a rule prohibiting bad faith in trademark filings. While an administrative review panel originally favored Hasbro and the historical refiling precedent or practice, an appeal board reversed this decision last month and sent the EU trademark world into a new reality. The appeal board held that when a party seeking cancellation of a trademark uses objective factors to support a claim of bad faith, the burden of proof shifts to the trademark owner to prove its use of good faith in the filing. That can be incredibly difficult to do when the new application contains identical or substantially similar marks or goods and services covered, as was the case for Hasbro. Hasbro appeared to admit clearly on the record that an important reason for the refiling was the resetting of the grace period to minimize administrative burdens of maintaining the trademarks, and the appeal board latched heavily onto this in their decision. So the Monopoly brand is vulnerable to more competition in Europe, which puts Hasbro in a somewhat similar spot as in the US, where the suffix "opoly" has been deemed to be descriptive and allowed for all similar game competitors to use for many years. More importantly, the overall filing and maintenance strategy for trademarks in the EU has changed for all brand owners, as now avoiding the proof of use requirement is very difficult. And it all stems back to a case about the tabletop game Monopoly. Go figure. The bottom line is, while the appeal board made a drastic change in trademark law and practice in the European Union with this decision, the end result may be an EU trademark system more in line with how brand owners must prove use to actually obtain an enforceable registration in many other jurisdictions. Consistency is a good thing for companies doing worldwide business, so this may be a welcome change despite the increased cost that will be incurred for collecting and submitting the proof of use evidence when the grace periods have run out. One might say the EU no longer has a monopoly on enforcing non-use trademarks, but we don't want to be too on the nose.
Thanks for listening. Please provide feedback and segment suggestions to me on Twitter at BuckeyeFitzy.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network.
Frog Pants Network.
Get more shows like this at frogpants.com.